Welcome to Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism production. I'm Josie Day.
And I'm Ziska Mayadeen. This episode of Making a Difference has been produced by journalism students at Deakin University on What the Wrong Country.
Coming up on the program, a story about combating the loneliness epidemic.
And we go inside a youth justice centre to find out how therapy dogs are helping young offenders.
But first, this story by Ali Calafiori explores the topic of period poverty and the push for free access to period products.
Periods aren't the most enjoyable experience at the best of times, but with the cost of living crisis continuing, many Australians who menstruate are now finding it hard to afford a basic necessity in the form of period products such as pads and tampons. This has caused growing calls to make period products free and accessible from all public institutions around Australia to help eradicate the growing issue of period poverty. Period poverty refers to the many barriers that cause a lack of access to safe menstrual hygiene. In a recent survey by Plan International, it was found that almost 60% of Australians who menstruate have struggled at some point during the cost of living crisis to afford period products. As a result, many either ended up buying cheaper products, changing them less often, or even foregoing using products at all. It's a story that Brittany Edwards, Marketing and Communications Coordinator of charity Share the Dignity, is all too familiar with.
This could mean that they're having to choose between food for their family or buying period product. We've also heard stories of people cutting their pads into three, for example, so they last longer. And it also means that you have like effects not only on your physical health, but also on your mental health.
Share the Dignity has partnered with over 3,000 charities around Australia to help combat period poverty, one endeavour being the Dignity Vending Machine. Machines that distribute free period packs containing 6 tampons and 2 pads, enough to help someone for a day.
So they're installed in high traffic areas where people might be who need support. So homeless shelters, domestic violence refuges, Aboriginal medical services, community centres, libraries, charities, etc. Push a button on the machine and it dispenses a period pack with 2 pads and 6 tampons. Enough for a day, and it also gives somebody choice.
While state governments are seeing great success with the trial periods of these vending machines in a select few public institutions, the Greens are pushing for policy at a federal level to ensure that every public building has access to one, particularly within the public school system. Greens Senator for Queensland and leader of the Greens in the Senate, Larissa Waters, has done the numbers and believes that placing one of these vending machines in every public school in Australia could easily be done within the federal government's yearly budget.
We had the Parliamentary Budget Office cost to put vending machines in all public schools, and it was $25 million a year, which is pittance when it comes to government expenditure.
In Share the Dignity's 2021 Bloody Big survey, it was found that of the students affected by period poverty, 19% had their education impacted due to having to stay home because of a lack of period products, a statistic Larissa Waters says is unacceptable.
It's not like you have to pack your own toilet paper when you go to school. So by the same reasoning, you should not have to pack your own pads and tampons. It's a question of dignity, and it's a question of making kids feel safe and comfortable to continue to go to school.
Currently, while government schools in all states and territories have programs in place to provide free period products, Queensland is so far the only state to have installed Dignity vending machines in 147 public schools, a number both Share the Dignity and the Greens hopes increases in the future.
Next, we delve into the world of One Piece, the Japanese animation series that Shay Hambling discovers could be bigger than Harry Potter.
The Great Pirate Era. Setting off a race across the seas to find the Pirate King's hidden treasure. The One Piece.
You either know it or have never heard of it before. Well, what if I told you it's said to take over Harry Potter in terms of popularity?
One Piece is a Japanese anime that has gained popularity in the Western world, with its niche storyline, relatable characters, and creative world-building. The story revolves around the adventures of a pirate named Monkey D. Luffy and his crew who are on a quest to find a treasure which is named One Piece. One Piece has been around for 24 years and has now adapted a live action on popular streaming service Netflix. Fans around the world have compared One Piece's popularity to fantasy novel and franchise Harry Potter, with some people saying it will be even bigger. Diehard fan Dylan Mader has been watching anime since he was 8 years old, being first introduced to the world by his sisters as they watched the popular anime Sailor Moon.
I think it was my first time I got on the computer and started streaming. I typed in One Piece and it was about 379 episodes, I think it was. I've been watching One Piece ever since then.
Mader said that nothing can compare to One Piece and believes the story is one of a kind.
If you really give it time and try to understand it for yourself and actually watch it, it will bring tears to your eyes and you'll think, wow, this is really well thought out and this is why it's been going for so long. And the Harry Potter fans are cult fans for the reason of they watch all 7 movies, these actors grew up, and that is it. One Piece has such a depth to it where it's not one plot that covers 7 stories. It is a plot that covers multiple arcs and multiple characters within themselves.
The franchise has currently sold 516 million copies of the comic book and has reached the number one spot on Netflix globally, with 37.8 million views worldwide within only 2 weeks of streaming. ScreenHub Australia's film and content lead Sylvie Van Wall has been a diehard fan of One Piece for only 2 years now, as they began watching it during the COVID lockdown.
My brother-in-law is super into it and he kept pushing me and my partner, like, you really got to watch it. Yes, there's over 1,000 episodes, but you can start now because we're in lockdown.
With a filmmaking background, Sylvie said that emotion is the heart of every story and being able to connect to a character is vital.
I think when most people get hooked into the series, it's when they realize how emotional it is. And One Piece has a great way of doing it. It's kind of known for its backstories and showing you, you know, the depth of every character, even the villains. That's the heart at the center of this really goofy anime that has, like, you know, a lot of punching, a lot of action. But when you get into it, you're like, oh, this is actually really complex and it has a lovely depth to it.
With the anime now on Netflix and the live action recently renewed for a second season, Sylvie said they can definitely see One Piece gaining more traction in the Western world. The film writer stated that Harry Potter fans have fallen off the bandwagon due to the controversies around J.K. Rowling and the trans community.
People compare them just because of their pop culture impact, you know, because Harry Potter was so huge and One Piece is huge. You know, I personally left everything Harry Potter behind.
Mader said that One Piece has changed his life and sees the series becoming the biggest in the world. He points all success of the live action to the writer's dedication to the story.
People are going to come to the realization that this is one of the most abstract, unique stories ever written on paper. And Oda himself is a writing genius.
I think people should give One Piece a go if they like Looney Tunes sort of humor with Orange is the New Black heart, you know, like characters that get really explored and get given their moments to shine.
Season 1 of One Piece's live action is now streaming on Netflix.
In our next story, Mariam Ashraf and Molly Howie explore the emergence of AI-generated music and its impact on the industry, artists, and fans.
It could make humans irrelevant.
We've all heard of artificial intelligence, the device that uses intelligent computer algorithms to generate content of all sorts, including books and movies.
Well, now AI is entering the realm of music, with melodies, harmonies, and entire songs emerging through AI programs. And it's this almost effortless and instant production of musical content that has the music industry reeling. But who's to say AI and human musicians aren't to collaborate? Superkind is a band composed of 5 AI members and 5 real humans. But can AI really capture the depth of human emotion and connection that is often vital to the elements of a song? Singer and songwriter Harriet Brott, also a member of Australian band Frankie, believes that whilst AI may assist by providing the building blocks of a song, it'll never truly capture human emotion.
I've definitely had a fiddle around with ChatGPT before, once or twice, putting like prompts in to see what it spits out, or putting some lyrics in that I've already written to find like the next line. It does write songs, but I don't think it writes good songs. I would like to think that we can use AI as a tool to enhance our songwriting and our performance and such, but rather than something that will replace us as musicians and songwriters, I would like to think that people will always resonate with human feeling and emotion. And I don't know if that will ever be able to be conveyed with such a strong message through AI.
But is AI music here to stay? Or is it yet just another viral trend marked with an expiration date?
Joshua Peterson is a law professor at Melbourne University, specialising in AI and digital ethics.
Overall, AI is here to stay. Artificial intelligence, you know, it's only getting more and more prevalent in our daily lives. In terms of AI in the music industry, well, AI has revolutionized music for years, you know, in composition and enhancing production and even the distribution side of things. I think people forget that, you know, AI has been a part of the music industry for years because AI intelligence is used to, you know, mix tracks, add instruments, generate the voice of humans and create songs. There are some questions, though, about whether or not this is ethical because the ethics guidelines for AI, it states that one, it needs to be fair, and obviously this can be questioned as to whether or not this is fair, you know. Another is trust, you know, in this code of ethics, and trust is a big thing for humans. And if AI is breaking that, then that is especially a big problem.
One of the most important factors of the success of AI music is listeners like you, the audience who, through streams, can decide the fate of AI-produced songs.
Charlotte Dring listens to music every day, but doesn't think that AI music itself will enter her playlists anytime soon.
Probably just listen to like melodies while studying. I feel like that's not a bad idea. But I also would listen to it to an extent that I don't want it to take over normal music because it's hard enough for local artists to break into the music world without more competition from AI. Like, I personally really enjoy like authentic live music and like instruments and lyrics and stuff that aren't computer generated. But I realize it's starting to incorporate into our world and it's hard to avoid. And I might not even realize it these days.
Is there still a place in music for AI, even if that doesn't mean singers and band members?
Well, I have actually been using the DJ on Spotify a little bit, and I like when it shows me new music, and I think it will be similar like how TikTok has allowed other music to blow up. I think the way that like Spotify's DJ or other AI tools, they might help with that, and I think that's a pretty good idea.
It seems AI music has a long way to go before we truly know the legacy it'll leave in the music industry.
Now, we head to Tasmania, where Vaya Bradley is finding out why there are so many roosters on roadsides.
If you go for a drive down just about any given road in Tasmania, whether that be in country towns or on roads as urban and busy as the Southern Outlet, you may see roosters hanging about and wandering by the bitumen. The unfortunate reality is that for many hobby farmers and those with backyard flocks, there isn't any real use for a rooster and nowhere to send them. The roosters not only run the risk of disease and death, they are also significant road hazards. Kesha Huntington, founder of Commandy Ridge Farm Animal Sanctuary in Jeeveston, has taken several boys in through his gates, giving the rejected roosters a second chance. With around 50 roosters calling Commandy Ridge home, it's a welcome relief from the alternative.
For the majority of people that have been surrendering have just had, yeah, like two or three roosters along with a bunch of chickens and part of their sort of family thing. They're, you know, their little family flock and the kids love them and this and that. So yeah, definitely we've had a lot of relief of people saying, oh, I'm so glad that there's somewhere they can live.
The issue really comes down to the economics of keeping animals.
The main sort of issue is they don't necessarily give like an economic benefit generally to people. So chickens give eggs, cows really give milk, and as well they give more meat and things. So the males just generally are the surplus.
Tim Pawley, president of the Southern Tasmania Poultry Club, explained that a poultry amnesty, which is held four times a year at various locations, have been successful in reducing the number of birds dumped, and that the club helps people find their perfect feathered friend.
Plenty of birds are rehomed. We've got some people that ring the club and say, I'm looking for this type of rooster. So a utility type, whether it be a run-on red, a well summer, a leghorn, an Oshawa, or, you know, something was they want to breed, you know, their own poultry in their own backyard to replace their own lane. And then there's others that just want cute, fluffy ones.
The reign of roosters on the roadside could come to an end and has already proven fairly successful since the promotion of alternatives for unwanted poultry in the form of rescues and amnesties. Southern Tasmania Poultry Club President Tim Polley said that he's seen a reduction in the number of roosters on the roadside since the amnesties became a more widely known option.
Dramatically, and we get positive feedback from councils too.
This is Making a Difference, a Junction journalism production by journalism students at Deakin University. Now Ellie Claring-Bold and Jane Tyack take us inside a remand centre to find out what role dogs can play in helping young offenders.
We went up to this classroom and a couple of really big guys came up to the Perspex window when they saw my job and I'll bashing and kicking on the Perspex and yelling at me. And we went in and they were jumping around excited for about 3 seconds until they noticed that Myrtle, my dog, only had 3 legs. And they instantly, like, melted. I'm like, oh, my God, what happened to her? And then they were, like, they just got so super protective of her.
That's Megan Nutbean talking about her first experience inside the Parkville Youth Justice Precinct. Megan is the Community Programs Manager at Lord Smith, an animal hospital based in Victoria. For the past 20 years, they've run a pet therapy program that aims to bring the healing powers of dogs to those who need it most.
There's just something magical about that connection between people and dogs. Not all people and not all dogs, but for people that have that connection with dogs and for dogs that just love being around people, there's just a magic that happens and it's immediate.
Lord Smith's pet therapy program operates across a variety of settings, including paediatric wards, youth support facilities and aged care facilities. It was in 2019, at the request of the Department of Justice, that the program expanded to include the Parkville Youth Justice Precinct.
It's about helping young people who have experienced a lot of trauma and have other complex needs to really feel safe and feel regulated. And by getting young people into those states where they are emotionally regulated, you kind of open up spaces for them to be able to connect with other people.
But she says it's also about letting these children just be kids for a while.
There's a lot going on for them. They're in constant fight or flight mode and to be able to just run around with dogs or roll around on the floor patting a dog that's completely full of love and non-judgmental, yeah, I think it just has a really profound impact on the young people.
Pet therapy volunteer Jo Riley is no stranger to these profound impacts. She and her staffy Maisie have been volunteering at the Parkville Youth Justice Precinct for the past 4 years.
Maisie connected with one young guy and she wouldn't leave his door for some reason. We don't know. They couldn't interact physically, but she just sat by his door and, yeah, they just made this amazing connection. Then we went back. Oh, gosh, it was probably a couple of months later and he recognised Maisie and Maisie just basically went to him.
Joe and Maisie visit the Youth Justice Precinct every fortnight and Joe says they saw this particular young person quite regularly. As luck would have it, they even got to see him on the day of his release.
We happened to be there that day, so it was quite emotional. The connection between the both of them and, you know, they both kind of said goodbye to each other.
So what is it about our connection with dogs that is able to elicit such powerful and long-lasting effects? Well, Melanie Jones, founder of Animal Assisted Therapy Service Lead the Way, says it all comes back to science and our human biology.
What happens to us in the presence of an animal is that our engagement system gets switched on. So we might produce the love hormone, oxytocin. We might produce happy and feel-good hormones that help us to engage, that improve our mood, that make us feel less worried. If we kind of think about that as the springboard for what's happening, that kind of makes a whole lot of other things possible.
She says that for children in detention, the benefits of animal-assisted therapy – can be particularly effective.
And if we think about the extreme trauma history of most of these kids, they probably almost never feel safe or connected. And yet it's one of the primary needs of all humans. So in that context, I guess it's not surprising that you bring an animal in who suddenly allows you to feel safe and connected. That just by itself is amazing. But then what if you're allowed to touch the dog? So you're not really allowed to touch anyone else in prison. You don't get cuddles. You don't get long hugs. But the dog can provide that.
And provide, they do. For Jo Riley, volunteering with children in detention is as rewarding as it is eye-opening.
A lot of these kids too, they come from quite vulnerable family lives, you know. That's all they know. You know, they don't live a privileged life, a lot of them. I suppose you have to be there to see it, but I wish that more people would give some of the kids a bit more of a chance in life.
Thankfully, the future of the program looks bright. The team at the Lord Smith Animal Hospital are striving to continue building on their work within youth justice settings. They hope to develop parole programs and employment pathways for children who have been in detention, helping them to sustain the skills they've learned during their time with the dogs.
In any environment our pet therapy volunteers go into and bring that doggy magic, I think it's such a privilege, like, to be able to be part of that and to be able to be there for those moments and just help create them.
In this next story, Ben Cashin and Kathy Langley talk to people who have suffered loneliness and explore what is being done to tackle the problem.
Content warning, this episode contains references to mental health and substance abuse. If you find anything discussed in this episode distressing, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14 or see show notes for links for support.
Loneliness. It's a word that seems mutually exclusive to the busy and interconnected lives we lead today. We are surrounded by opportunities to engage in the happenings of our community and the rest of the world. But the truth is, loneliness and social isolation continue to grow.
According to a landmark Australian report, 1 in 3 Australians are experiencing loneliness, and it's not just an issue here in Australia. It's global. The US Surgeon General has declared it a loneliness epidemic, and Australia is stepping up to create awareness and action. But what is loneliness?
So it's your craving for that social connection you don't have. It can really be something that anyone can experience at any stage of their life.
That's Professor Melody Ding, an epidemiologist and population behavioural scientist. She's from the University of Sydney and has dedicated her career to global research into loneliness and its prevalence.
I guess we evolve to feel lonely so that we reach out to people because we survive better as a group together, as human beings.
While loneliness is part of our natural instinct to make sure we connect, it has the ability to manifest into something deeper and potentially harmful.
We're really worried about is chronic loneliness. That's when people experience loneliness for extended period of time repeatedly.
Chronic loneliness has been found to increase the likelihood of depression, anxiety, stress levels, and insomnia. Not knowing where or who to turn to can be vital to someone's life.
I think we really need to have more investment into understanding what are driving loneliness in Australia and what lessons we can learn from around the world.
The State of the Nation report released by Ending Loneliness Together Australia revealed that young people aged 18 to 24 reported feeling the most lonely and disconnected.
There's been lots of happy moments in my life and lots of great relationships. I don't want to emphasise the tragedy of it too much. It's definitely been a predominant theme.
That's Alex Arthur. He joined us to share his struggles with loneliness.
I'm a 24-year-old student. I'm a disability advocate. I've always felt different. Growing up with cerebral palsy in the late 90s, early 2000s, Australia was quite difficult. But the acceptance of disability just wasn't there. I learned that being disabled was wrong, a huge part of my identity was wrong, and that I had to overcome, or at the very least deny my experiences in order to fit in.
These experiences led Alex to feel isolated and alone, wondering what version of himself would be considered acceptable in the eyes of his peers and community.
I had tried to cover over my need for connection through kind of overworking, drinking, trying to appear a certain way, trying to play up some traits while minimizing others, basically just doing everything that I could. And when I was about 21, my mental health broke down quite severely, and that forced me to go, okay, if I don't do this, I will probably seriously injure or hurt myself in some way. And that's when I started going to therapy and realizing, oh, this is what I'm like, and this is why. And then things started to make a lot more sense in the years following that.
Stories like Alex's and his journey in trying to deal with chronic loneliness aren't uncommon, and the stigma around loneliness and mental health is what can make this journey so much harder.
One program making a splash within the loneliness prevention and action space is Man on Purpose. We joined one of the program directors, Steph Supich, for one of their early morning beach sessions.
Starting here in 3, 2, 1, breathing in, 2.
We created a community down at Henley Beach, initially as a men's group. And it was a men's group where we wanted our brothers to come together to do some breath work, meditation, to simply give back the tools and modalities that have helped us in our lives and share it with the greater community.
With excitement, with anticipation, we know we have everything we need and we are the best version of ourselves right now.
It's so much more than just the things that we share. And yes, you come down for an hour to experience potentially something new, but it's ultimately the friendships and the people that you meet.
They are doing some amazing work. It is incredible just how positive the reception can be when we open up, and we thank all our guests for doing so with us.
We've seen just how impactful loneliness can be. We know that it's among us, but what you should know is that there is always hope. You are not alone, and there are people out there ready to take on the loneliness epidemic.
And that story by Ben Cashin and Kathy Langley finishes our program. For more of the best stories in student journalism around Australia, go to our website, junctionjournalism.com. And don't forget, there's a new episode of Making a Difference every month. You can subscribe on your favourite podcast app. I'm Josie Day.
And I'm Ziska May Dean. Thanks for tuning in.